Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for signing up and dialing in to Navigate the Housing Bubble, Parts 1 and 2. Tonight is Part 1, and my name is Byron Belitzos. I'm your host, and I'm the CEO of Origin Press in Northern California. And tonight we're launching our two-part seminar on the most dangerous housing bubble in American history and what you need to know to protect yourself while growing your wealth. Well, if you're just now dialing in, welcome, everyone. As most of you know, Catherine Austin Fitz, our guest tonight and every night on these teleseminars, was the Assistant Secretary of Housing and the Federal Housing Commissioner during the Bush 1 administration. She joined the administration in 1989, and soon thereafter she was the lead financial advisor to FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, during the first term of President Clinton. And so I think we can say that Catherine knows a thing or two about real estate. And tonight Catherine is going to talk about the macro big picture of housing in the United States. Catherine, as most of you know, watched as an insider as the senior financial leadership in this country engineered today's spectacular housing bubble in much the same way that they manufactured the stock market bubble of the late 90s. Well, we all know what happened to the high-tech stock bubble, and tonight we're going to ask the question and answer the question, what's ahead for the housing bubble? So again, tonight we're going to start with a macro look, top-down look at the bubble, including looking at the roots of the problem going back almost a century in this country. And we especially are going to look at understanding how the housing market relates to the larger context of tapeworm economics. And next week's seminar, Catherine, will assist you in more of the micro issues and how you and your family can deal with this unprecedented situation. So we're going to launch in a minute. I wanted to just remind you that if you haven't been to the homepage of this teleseminar, it's at solari.com/outreach/telesem. You can see the list of the seminars there. You can click into this one and get in there and look at what this one's about tonight and scan that as we begin. And you'll be able to see you'll see a link there to the outline of what we're going to do tonight if you'd like to see that. And if you haven't been to the readings, they're just page down. You'll see the readings. And as usual, we'd like to ask you to email questions to us as we're going through this teleseminar, and the questions should be sent to info@solari.com, info@solari.com, and we'll pick those up, and we will be screening those as we go in the next hour, and at 1 hour into this, we're going to do Q&A with your questions. So, folks, thank you again for joining us, and I'd like to launch right away with Catherine Austin Fitz. And Catherine, I want to kind of open up with a question to you about your own home and how you grew up in the housing where you were when you started out in life.
Well, actually, you know, that's how I got into all of this. I grew up in West Philadelphia. If you've seen the movie Rocky, that was South Philadelphia. If you listen to Bill Cosby, that was North Philadelphia. West Philadelphia, Byron, was a world of, you know, little brownstones. My dad came home from World War II and bought a little brownstone. He was a doctor with a VA mortgage, which is like an FHA mortgage, but it's a government-guaranteed mortgage. And I watched, it was a poor neighborhood, but it was wonderful. And I know some of the people listening tonight have heard me talk about the Popsicle Index.
Yes.
The Popsicle Index is the percent of people in a place who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. So when I was a little girl growing up in West Philadelphia, the Popsicle Index was 100%. It was so 100% of the people in that neighborhood thought it was safe for a child to run up to Spruce Street, buy a popsicle, and come home alone to where I lived. And so, we were poor, but we didn't know. We thought, you know, life was very wonderful. It was a very safe and a very sweet place. What happened was in the early 60s, we were targeted by two things, both HUD fraud and drugs. And the combination of the HUD fraud, there were four home builder sort of fraudster deals done on the corner. And Byron, it wiped out the value of all the equity value of all the homes. And in those days, all of our savings was in our homes. That was our life savings. And so it wiped out the life savings of, you know, say 50 to 100 homeowners contiguous to those sort of HUD fraudster deals. The drugs came in at the same time, and I watched a neighborhood really deteriorate. And intuitively, then I understood that the equity value being destroyed was far greater than the money that anybody was making from the fraud and the drugs.
Yes.
And I remember I used to walk by these, because what they do is when they foreclose on the HUD homes, they at that time they boarded them up, and they were boarded up for 4 years. And I had a neighbor, six people in a family living in a one bedroom apartment. And just as a child, I used to think, this is crazy. It doesn't make sense that these folks wouldn't own a home and, you know, these things are boarded up. And so I'd walk by and I'd see a sign, and it would say, by order of the Assistant Secretary of Housing, Federal Housing Commissioner, one of the longest titles in the federal government. And I used to think, who is that asshole? And then when, I'll never forget, I was being sworn in as Assistant Secretary of Housing, and then Jack Kemp said, you know, by order vested in me, the president, blah, blah, blah. I had my hand on the Bible. You know, you are now the assistant secretary. And I thought, oh, no, I'm the asshole. And sure enough, you know, when I became assistant secretary, there were 50,000 homes in America, you know, boarded up in default. It was at the end of the sort of SNL Iran-Contra period.
Yeah.
And twice now I've tried to turn that around and change that, thinking, you know, because I'm – what's astonishing is if you look at the economics of that, a low popsicle index costs the federal government, you know, millions of dollars in losses every year, but the losses to the homeowners and the community of a low popsicle index are even far greater. And so if you could turn that around, it's a fantastic human value increase, but a fantastic, you know, financial capital gains as well. And so much of my work has been trying to understand why that happens, how could that happen, that so many people in the country could be making money off of a falling popsicle index. And then, of course, what do we, you know, how do we turn around? What do we do about it? So it really did start for me at a very young age.
So tonight we're gonna do the part one of this, and maybe take a minute, Catherine, and kind of distinguish how tonight is going to be different from next Thursday night.
Yeah, I'll never forget, I told you this story earlier. I was, after I'd left the Federal Housing Administration and we started my first company, Hamilton Securities, I was sitting in the office and my secretary came in and said, oh, there's an urgent call from the chairman of the SEC. He says it's urgent. And it was a fellow I very much liked, and I picked up and I said, you know, yes, Richard. And I was expecting some major global financial question. He said, oh, thank God I got you. I just need to know, should I refinance my mortgage now or should I wait? And, you know, mostly when you talk about homes or housing, we tend to focus on the financial issues of should I refinance, you know, how much is my house worth, should I buy, should I sell, should I help my grandchild buy a house. You know, is residential real estate an investment opportunity? Because we're talking about what has been for the last 10 years one of the most profitable industries in the country.
Yes.
And obviously there's a lot of uncertainty now in the financial markets, both the mortgage markets and other markets. But what I want to do, Byron, is discuss today the history and the background of our current situation, because I think if we're going to have, to navigate the housing bubble, you need a good map of how the housing bubble has happened and how the housing bubble intersects with a lot of other economic and political decisions that we're all grappling with. Because historically, mortgage and housing credit have been one of the chief tools that what I call the pro-centralization team or the tapeworm has used to centralize the economy. And so political and economic control of neighborhoods, of places, of counties, of towns is very much exercised through the mortgage credit and through financing homes. And in addition, a lot of the most non-accountable, non-transparent money managed by the government, I know a lot of folks have heard me write and talk about the black budget, is also connected and managed through and with mortgage credit. And so it's very important to have a good map, because both the risks and a lot of opportunities, in any period of uncertainty, there are always extraordinary opportunities. To take advantage of those opportunities, you really need a map of the big picture. So this is one of those environments where you really need to know what the weather's like before you go out and you go sailing.
So this is almost a cosmic question, you might say. And so why don't we move right in, Catherine, and start with a look at the history of U.S. housing and mortgage credit and how it
evolved.
Right.
The centralization of the financial system really, there are different ways to describe it, but there are a couple of key points where that really create the foundation, Byron, for creating a non-accountable financial system. And by non-accountable financial system, I mean a financial system that continues to grow and make money even if the popsicle index is falling.
Right.
So it's a financial system that feeds the inside players, the tapeworm, rather than serving the people, you know, that it's supposed to serve. And I started in 1913 with the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank, which was essentially a decision by the Congress and the leadership to create a private bank that would, in essence, control both our currency, create and manage the currency, and manage and control the banking and debt system. So you gave a private corporation the ability to do those things without disclosing who their equity owners were and what the policies were of sharing the very rich data that comes off of that and sort of the insider trading potential with, you know, without disclosing what the policies were about their equity owners having and controlling and managing that data. So you really turned the credit spigot over to a bunch of private players without, any kind of accountability teeth or feedback.
So this is almost like the ultimate in insider trading. Can a layperson say that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, think about it. If you're the Federal Reserve banks around the country, and you have all the data about how the money works in all the places, and you're free to share that. You know, I once wrote and called all the Federal Reserve banks around the country and said, you know, who manages your databases, and what are the policies of sharing that data with your your members and their equity investors? And they wrote back and said, you know, that's confidential.
There you go. There's your
there you go.
Let alone the American people, right?
Right.
Who are really in charge of this. Well, used to be. They lost their sovereignty. And when was that, 1913 when this?
Yeah. I mean, 1913 is a big step towards losing financial and information sovereignty, which is something we're going to touch on again.
Okay.
In 1934, after the Depression began, you had huge mortgage defaults. At the time, mortgages, most homes in this country were financed with relatively short bank debt. So you'd get a 1 or 5 year mortgage and then roll it over. So at that point, you had much more farmland as part of the economy. And the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, which is now part of HUD, was created, and that created, using government guarantees or a government fund guarantee, the Federal Housing Administration funds, the first 30-year or long-term mortgage. And it's since then, it's been a succession of government guarantees that have really built the very significant mortgage market in the United States, the size that it is.
Yeah, let's make sure people understand this guarantee. This is
sure.
A form of insurance, right?
Right. Let me give you an example, and there are many permutations. But, for example, let's say your bank wants to make a mortgage loan to you to buy a house.
Yes.
So what they can do is they can go to the FHA and get the FHA fund to guarantee that mortgage. So they're not looking to you to pay it. They are looking to you, but in the worst case, if you should fail to pay it, they can go to the FHA and say, I want 99 cents on the dollar.
And they can get 99 cents on the dollar.
And they can get 99 cents on the dollar.
No questions asked.
No questions asked. So they're looking to the FHA fund for the creditworthiness of the mortgage.
Got it.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
And that has a very profound impact to society because both that and another step that was taken in the 80s, which is the banks develop the ability to take, let's say I have 1,000 mortgages in my bank and I want to pool them all up and sell them as securities in the marketplace. what was created with Freddie, Fannie, and Ginny Mae at HUD was a series of government-sponsored enterprises or government agencies that would then facilitate that process, including giving government guarantees or indirect government guarantees supporting it, which meant that the bank could then turn around and sell its mortgages as securities. And so once it was originated, you know, the bank had made its fee or still had a servicing fee, but the bank was not liable for the mortgages. So let me explain what this means. Let's say I have a neighborhood with 1,000 homes.
Right.
And let's say I finance them with 1,000 mortgages that I, the local bank, hold in my portfolio.
Yes.
Well, if somebody should bring drugs into that neighborhood, I could lose a great deal of money.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
So what would I do? I'd make sure that the drugs couldn't come in, or I'd, you know, whatever. I would do something to prevent it.
Right.
Now, let's say instead they're all government guaranteed and they're pulled up in mortgage-backed securities that have been sold off with government guarantees. If all those mortgages default, I just make new ones, right?
So there goes the incentive.
Right. So I lack incentive. In an equity-based financial system, all the different businesses, banks, and players have tremendous vested interest in making sure the Popsicle Index stays high, because if it doesn't, they lose money.
So an equity-based would be good for the Popsicle Index, and a debt-based is quite the opposite.
Generally speaking,
okay.
You'll notice on the event resource page and the teleseminar page, I put a quote from Dick Ravitch, who said, I was sitting at the Jockey Club in 1997, and he looked at me and he said, as long as I can get government subsidies, what do I care if people have education or jobs?
There you have it.
And he was talking about the HUD budget, and basically what he was saying is, you know, I want government guarantees to basically protect all of my interests. And since I get government guarantees and I can make money on guarantees, I really don't care, you know, if there's any fundamental economic productivity or if the people have education or are productive.
So that's what we're talking about here.
Right. That is one of the critical issues that we're talking about is, do we have an economy that's based on productivity, or do we have an economy that feeds the tapeworm? And unfortunately, and this is, we've seen this very much in the mortgage credit, the idea of bringing in all these government guarantees has, as it turned out, fed the tapeworm. Another thing happened in 1934, Byron, which was the creation of the Exchange Stabilization Fund, or the ESF. The ESF is a fund managed by the New York Fed on and for and behalf of the Secretary of the Treasury. And traditionally, the Exchange Stabilization Fund has been the primary slush fund for managing a whole series of market manipulations. You know, when you talk about the black budget, most people sort of see the plane coming into the MENA airport and, you know, Iran-Contra drugs loaded off, and they think of black budget as sort of, you know, things that happen on the ground. They don't think of intervention in the stock and bond markets and in the financial markets, manipulation, insider trading as part of the black budget. But in fact, both in terms of generating money for the black budget and in reinvestment of money from the black budget, market manipulation, the financial side is as big, if not a bigger side, than the asset side of the balance sheet. So the ESF was created, and what we see as history evolves, a history of sort of the black budget in America, the two are very much connected. Two other things that happened that are critical to the story of building a non-accountable financial system. One was in 1947 we created the National Security Act, and then in 1949 the CIA Act. And what those two acts, Byron, together did was they gave the CIA and the National Security Council the ability to claw money out of any government agency and use it on a non-accountable, non-transparent, non-disclosed basis.
We
literally created a legal mechanism for us to borrow money to the U.S. Treasury and spend it for secret projects with absolutely no transparency, accountability, or any standard of performance.
Amazing.
It is amazing.
Now, this ESF, is that, can you say just a bit about that? Is that a key factor today, or was it just back then? Or
the ESF, in my estimation, and it's a guess, the ESF is a major factor today in the manipulation of the mortgage markets, the gold markets, and a lot of different black budget operations. One of the most delicious sort of beginning descriptions of the ESF, Christopher Simpson has a wonderful book called Blowback, where he describes the Dulleses pulling the money back from the money seized from the Nazis who'd seized it from the people who went into the camps. They pulled it back, put it in the ESF, and sitting at Sullivan and Cromwell in New York, proceeded to use the money to rig the Italian elections in 1948 at the request of the Vatican.
Jeez. Okay.
So there's a long history here, and it includes up until today.
And another layer is the National the Security Council and the CIA as well, having their way of raiding the treasury as well.
Well, you combine the NSC and CIA mechanism to basically, you know, I mean, think of it as a straw right into the pea soup of the treasury, which can be financed with U.S. Treasury securities. You combine that with the ESF's power under the law to intervene and manipulate financial markets, and you have a machinery that is one of the most, probably the most ingenious financial machineries ever created. I mean, if you want to know how the matrix finances, this is how it finances. And it's incredibly powerful as a financial mechanism because you can combine the high profit margins of organized crime with the incredible liquidity of the U.S. Treasury financing with stock market and financial markets. And so you literally can set the inside players up to be basically finance for free at the expense of everybody else. And very much at the heart of it is not just the mortgage system, but in over the last 10 years, the mortgage bubble.
And we're up to about 1960, or where are we now?
Oh, I'm in 1980.
Yeah, you're up at it. Okay, let's jump up to 1980.
Okay, well, things took a real turn, turn to the aggressive in 1980 when Reagan Bush were elected. A couple things happened that are sort of, sometimes something can happen in the legal mechanics of government, Byron, and no one notices it, but it's got a huge butterfly effect. It's what I call a trim flap, which you turn this little thing here and you change the whole planet. First, after Reagan Bush came in, an executive order was issued that gave control to Bush Sr. To the entire enforcement, intelligence, and National Security Council infrastructure. So basically the entire covert side of the federal government and enforcement was turned over to the former head of the secret police.
Okay? Yep.
So that's really the fox in the chicken coop because, in Bush you had somebody who really knew how to get that machinery to dance.
Okay.
The second thing that happened was they created another executive order that said private corporate contractors were eligible to be used to do highly sensitive national security and intelligence operations. Now, what those two things meant was that Bush could control the entire covert operation of the government, and according to this non-transparent mechanism, financial mechanism, could issue on a non-transparent secret basis contracts to his pals all day long.
Right.
Okay. So what you're talking about is turning around to Halliburton, DynCorp, Lockheed Martin, et cetera, and issuing them an infinite amount of contracts to do whatever you want in secret.
So this is what started in the Reagan administration, and what was the result?
Well, I don't know, but I'll tell you, you give me that mechanism and we can transform the world, which they did. But the third thing they did was Stanley Sporkin, who's a name, if you said to me, who do we put in jail? Who do we hold accountable for the mortgage bubble? One of my choices for number one spot would be Stanley Sporkin. Stanley Sporkin, at the time, was the general counsel of the CIA. So during Iran-Contra, he was the lawmaker at the CIA. And Stanley Sporkin, when Stanley Sporkin was general counsel, the CIA entered into a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Justice that said if the CIA was aware of drug dealing or other illegalities by a variety of its assets, anything just about other than a case officer, it didn't have to report it to the Department of Justice. What those two executive orders plus that memorandum of understanding created was a construct whereby private corporations could be paid by the government to do illegal things.
Making a devastating case for this black operations.
Right. Now, at the same time, on Wall Street, and I was a part of it, we invented mortgage-backed securities, which allowed these mortgages to be pooled and sold with government guarantees.
Okay.
Those, and one other thing happened, sort of the last leg of creating a really, on the financial side, non-accountable financial system, and that was the Department of Justice stole Promise Software from Inslaw, who had developed it for, as a contractor to the Department of Justice, and turned it over to a group of other contractors, including DynCorp, that I've written about, and is one of the articles linked on the event resource page. What that did was that essentially gave the intelligence and enforcement operations the ability to compromise, and I'm grossly oversimplifying, to compromise financial systems through the settlement system, both with respect to privacy of data and transactions. You know, for example, we keep hearing about, you know, somebody hacking into a computer system and getting all the names out of NexusLexis or Bank of America.
Right.
This is the, you know, the promise type software problems. But you combine those things. So we have a series of contractors who are being paid to engage in organized crime as a matter of state.
Right.
And with no accountability, no transparency, and now what they have is they have the tools to crack any bank and steal money out of any bank in the world.
So this Promise Software enables them to literally do that without the bank knowing it.
Well, eventually the bank knows it.
When they see the missing money.
Right. It's back. It's more missing money.
Right.
Well, so during that period, you know, we've all heard about the S&L crisis. The S&L crisis, in my opinion, was really a financial fraud epidemic. When it was over, $500 billion was missing.
Right.
We've seen both in the Clinton administration, the second Bush administration, that group rise to power. Within that $500 billion, what you saw was a huge mortgage bubble, both residential, real estate, and both single-family and multifamily and commercial real estate, huge mortgage and real estate bubble, Byron, that burst at the end in 1989. And when that bubble burst, it's funny, I was a partner at a Wall Street firm, and we'd go to the board meetings, and everybody'd say, you know, is the bubble going to burst before the election? Oh, God, is the bubble going to burst? You know, so everybody knew it was coming. I walked in the door in 1989, and the bubble was bursting. You know, there was real fear because of the extent of the fraud. And I got to FHA. At the time, there was a $300 billion portfolio of single-family and multifamily mortgage insurance. About 80% of it was the single-family fund, which is required by law, Byron, to be self-supporting, which means the premiums you charge have to, you know, basically carry the load. And so I pulled in the guy who ran the budget, and I said, I need to see the financial statements and budgets for the FHA funds. So remember, this is $320 billion of paper, and we're originating $50 to $100 billion of mortgage guarantees a year, which is a pretty big size. So he brings the, you know, kind of wheelbarrows these documents back in, and they go from floor to ceiling, and I read them four times, and I call the guy back in, and I said, you know, I've read these four times, and nowhere can I find where it says how much money we're making or losing. You know, and I'm required under the law, I'm the fiduciary who's required by law to make sure this is self-supporting. So the guy says to me, he says, well, that's not in the budget. It doesn't say how much we're making or losing the budget. So I said, well, where does it, you know, where can I get that information? And he said, well, that information is with the accountants. And I said, well, give me their name. I want to talk to them. And he said, they report to another assistant secretary, and you're not allowed to speak to them. So I said, well, that's going to change. I spent a couple months lobbying the General Accounting Office, the White House, OMB, the Secretary's office, and to make a long story short, I got the accountants moved over to report to me.
Okay.
So they walk in the door, and it turns out we're losing $11 million a day in the single-family fund alone.
And they didn't know it. Nobody knew it. in your department.
Well, the accountants knew it, but
they knew it. Yeah.
But I wasn't allowed to know.
Right.
Okay. I wasn't allowed to talk to them. So I said, I almost fell off my chair, and I said, where are we losing the money? Because you have 80 field offices, so you have 80 field offices managers before you can tell them what to do. Anyway, so lo and behold, it turns out they said, we don't keep place-based financial information, so we have no idea where we're making or losing this money. So I said, well, this is an emergency. Go out and figure it out, sources and uses of cash flow. They came back 2 months later and said, we're losing all of our money in two regions. So we're making money in eight regions, and we're sustainable in eight regions, and we're non-sustainable in two regions. And sure enough, what were the regions? One was Texas.
Okay.
And I would like to point out that the Texas region included Arkansas, so you had the Clintons and Bushes in the same region.
All right.
And then Colorado, both areas of huge satellite, secret, black budget defense stuff.
Okay.
Anyway, so I got the financials for the Texas region, and I called the head of the Texas region, and I said, Sam, how much do you think you're making or losing every year? And he said, oh, I think we're breaking even. And I said, no, you lost $2.2 billion in Texas last year. I'm faxing you the information right now. So what I learned with the no place-based financials, I learned two things, Byron. One is the managers throughout the system had no, you know, they were flying blind.
Yeah.
But more importantly, what I discovered, in place after place, we were spending $250,000 a unit on public housing or housing when $50,000 would buy and rehab a single-family home.
Yeah.
So if you looked at the money on a place-based basis, there was tremendous ability and tremendous opportunity to re-engineer, but if you did that, then you were going to wreak havoc with the cash flows flowing to the various intermediaries, you know, whether it's not-for-profits or mortgage bankers or contracts for, you know, various players. We had an entire system that had grown up around tapeworm economics and sort of paying back your friends and had never been held to a standard of performance, and part of the burst of the bubble was fraud, but part of the burst of the bubble at the end of the 80s was we just had a huge amount of money and a huge amount of people running around and doing uneconomic things.
Yes.
And so what happened, as we cleaned up all the sort of losses in fraud, what I saw was a lot of the people who had sold that real estate at the top of the market, what's called a pump. So the market runs up, they pull their money out, were coming back in, and as things were auctioned off at the RTC, we're buying it back at 10 cents on the dollar. And that's when I first came to understand what the pump and dump of a stock or a market is.
Well, let's slow down a bit. So people were selling it at the top of the market.
Uh-huh.
And tell us what the RTC is.
The RTC was the Resolution Trust Corporation. When you had huge amounts of foreclosures, institutions, S&Ls, essentially went, as an economic matter, bankrupt or legally bankrupt, and then the government took them over as a receiver and then turned around and auctioned off all their assets. And I always, you know, you'll always hear me when I talk about missing money issues say again and again, crime that pays is crime that stays. The resolution process that we ran at that time never got the missing money back. So $500 billion left, and it was kept by the people who stole it. You know, whether you want to call it unethical or illegal, it depends on the niceties. But and as a result, who do we see running the government today? Well, it's all the people who rose to power during Iran-Contra.
Tell us again about the people that are selling it at the top of the market and coming back in and buying it at the bottom of the market and how that works.
Oh, well, you know, it's like the joy of cooking. There are 1,000 recipes, Byron.
Yeah, that's just one of them.
But essentially, if you watched who came back in to buy in the first couple of auctions and speak about opportunities. You know, if the bubble should burst again this time, which is not certain, but if you were nimble and quick at the burst in 89 and 90, I mean, there were people picking up, you know, office buildings in Houston for $1 million. It was pretty extraordinary. But the question was who had cash, and anybody who pulled out big cash and could bring it back in and buy was really in the catbird seat because liquidity dried up. It's important to remember what happened at that time to homeowners and to small businesses, because one of the things that happened when liquidity shut down, if you lost your job and needed to move, you couldn't sell your house.
Right.
You know, the liquidity dried up. If you had a big mortgage and lost your job, you couldn't carry the mortgage. You know, you defaulted and foreclosed.
Right.
The big corporations could continue to access money in the equity markets with the banking system slammed down and liquidity shut off. Small businesses were just choked, and so you had a lot of perfectly legitimate small businesses who continued to do well, but they just had their line of credits cut off, and it was a field day for the big corporations, because anybody who could get equity continued to be able to finance. You saw a lot of the bigger home builders who had access to the equity market start getting in the business of financing the little guy.
Right.
So it was through the cost of capital. It was just part of this continued process of centralization.
Got it.
One of the things that happened, Byron, is I saw a town as commissioner in New Mexico where 70% of the mortgages were in that town were in default and were held by Freddie, Fannie, or FHA. And one of the things I said at the time was, well, why don't they just create a stock corporation? Somebody was saying the community doesn't have any money, so they can't afford to buy the mortgages. I said, why don't they just create a stock entity and swap the stock for the mortgages? And everybody looked at me and said, huh. And that was one of the little mustard seeds for the Saleri model. I said, well, you know, I was on Wall Street. We never paid cash for anything. We just created a corporation and swapped securities.
So the little town there could have done that.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, little towns can do leverage buyouts, you know, not just global investors. Anyway, but we went through a process where the market, the mortgage market was bubbled.
Right.
And when it busted, you had a consolidation, you know, of the pro-centralization team at the cost of the little players. Now, within that milieu, there were little players who were nimble and quick. You know, when the wave crested and the market dumped, they were very clever and really jumped in and started to see the opportunity of taking advantage of that situation.
Got it.
So...
Well, so that brings us up to what point? We're in the 90s, late 90s?
The 1990s.
Yes.
The 1990s. So I left FHA, created Hamilton, with a mind's eye to figuring out how the little guys could jump back in by financing with equity. How could communities finance with equity and create their own software tools to bring transparency so that... you know, why should I pay $150 an hour to a government contractor through the federal budget to do something somebody in my neighborhood would love to do for $40 plus health care? So whether it was bringing transparency to the reoptimization of investment, governmental investment by place, or simply bringing equity to small business in a way that made money and created equity locally, there's a huge capital gains opportunity, because the biggest capital gains opportunity on the planet, Byron, is if you can finance a community with equity and then get the Popsicle Index from where it is today back to 100%, you're talking about huge capital gains. So, you know, off I went thinking, okay, well, you know, I can depend on the government for the rule of law. What happened unexpected to us was 3 years later we were hired back by HUD and FHA on competitive contract. And we ended up helping them with their auctions. Remember my old situation in West Philadelphia with the four defaulted homes?
Yes.
Well, in that situation, HUD ends up owning the mortgage because they've paid the mortgage banker or broker off. And so they end up with a mortgage. And traditionally, whereas the industry got a 75 cents on the dollar recovery rate, HUD got a 35 cents on the dollar recovery rate. So basically, you know, insiders were making a fortune. I mean, there were some ways, but you just had a process where insiders were, you know, eating the government alive. And so we were brought in to try and do something about that. As we did it, what I got was an inkling of the extent to which the Clinton administration planned to bubble the mortgage bubble. In 1994, FHA produced two things, its own business plan and... they also produced the affordable housing goals for Freddie and Fannie, the two government-sponsored enterprises that pool and create these mortgage-backed securities. And And so they set targets for what Freddie and Fannie should accomplish in terms of originations in low and moderate income neighborhoods. And I looked at the two projections and I said, wait a minute, you know, people in poor neighborhoods are going to have to finance and refinance their mortgages 2 and 3 times a year. One of the big initiatives going on at the time was prison privatization, and laws were being worked on and passed to radically increase the prison population. And so, you know, one of the things I said facetiously is everybody's going to have to refinance their home mortgage from jail twice, you know, in a year to make these targets. Mm-hmm. And I was basically taken aside and said, shut up. You know, this is none of your business. You just do your job. Mm-hmm. And so clearly there was a problem even then. And one of the things that was decided was to radically reduce the criteria by which you could finance your home, so lower the loan-to-value ratios. And to give you a sense of how bad it's become, I walked into the dentist, you know, several months ago, and lo and behold, there was a little sign saying I could go down to the courtroom and figure out how to refinance or buy a home at 100% loan-to-value, plus pay for all the transaction fees, plus borrow more to just take cash out of the deal. So if I'm short of cash, all I have to do is go buy a home and get some cash on top of it. So literally the financial system is paying you to buy a house.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. And so what you had was you had a tremendous bubble while several things that was going on that drained productivity. One was privatization. When we started to auction the mortgages, Byron, on the first deal, we created a process using AT&T Bell Laboratories optimization methodology that had been developed to route telephone calls. We set up a system whereby lots of the big and little bidders could bid and compete against each other. And what happened was it just drove prices way up.
Yeah.
It cracked whole new yields, and it sort of power shifted the insiders who were used to getting inside deals. One of the biggest players getting the inside deals was companies owned by Harvard Endowment. And during that, for Harvard University, I remember calling the big, the guy who runs the real estate portfolio, still does for Harvard University, Mike Eisenson. And I picked up the phone, or he picked up the phone, and before he even said hello, he said, F you. I'm not going to use the word on a teleseminar, but he said, F you. And I said, hi, Mike. And he said, I hate these loan sales. And I said, why? I think we're doing a terrific job. And he said, the only way I can win is to pay more than anybody else. And I said, well, Mike, that means I'm doing my job. And what I didn't read until I read Greg Palast and Ann Williamson about what was going on in Russia and Latin America is these same guys are running around the world and privatizing things at significantly below market value. And that's part of what has driven the, you know, the consolidation. And clearly in the mortgage market, you know, that was happening because you had the big players financing at a much lower cost of capital than everybody else. So so one was privatization, but the most important one that I want to stress to everybody tonight is we knew then, Byron, that globalization was going to mean that tremendous amounts of jobs were moved abroad.
Right.
And it was going to speed up the learning skills and the learning speeds that people in the workforce needed. So you needed to be in lifelong learning. Organizations needed to get very much smarter if we were going to stay productive in a global marketplace. So all of this was known. And sort of two models emerged. The model that I was a leader of was, and if you read my story, the story of Edgewood Technology Services, basically what I was saying is let's pay down our debt. We have too much debt. Let's significantly increase our productivity. Let's let small business compete for capital based on performance. And here's my vision, which is now sort of the Solari model. Here's my vision of how the economics work. And they were quite astonishing. For example, if you look at the cost of one woman on welfare with 1.8 children, the cost we calculated in HUD housing is over $55,000 a year. And yet for a relatively small amount of money, you can teach a person in that cohort how to do a job that generates $20,000 plus healthcare within a reasonable period of time in a way that they become a taxpayer. And so there was the potential reengineering was astonishing if you combine it with financing communities with equity. And in 1997, I showed the model to a group of pension fund leaders You know, and they said, oh, this is fabulous. We can save the country and, you know, get really rich. And that was important because the real concern, the number one financial concern at the time was the baby boomer generation was not going to be able to create enough economic value to fund the retirement benefits and health care benefits that we'd all promised ourselves. That's part of the debate you hear about the Social Security Fund. So we put forward this vision of sort of equity up and productivity up. That model was resoundingly rejected for, you know, more tapeworm economics, which is debt goes up, consumer debt goes up, government debt goes up, mortgage debt goes up, and as a result, we simply floated the economy from 96 on in an incredible sea of debt. And the terrifying thing about it was we knew then that many of the people who borrowed that money, whether mortgages or credit cards, could not pay it back. When you intentionally, systematically go to work at moving people's jobs abroad and flooding the country with immigrants, many of whom can take the jobs away, and at the same time encourage folks to borrow more and more money in a housing bubble that is not sustainable, what you do is you set someone up for a huge fall.
Picture.
Yeah, it's a very ugly picture. I have an article coming out in about 2 weeks on Fannie Mae, and it's called Franklin Wayne's Fannie Mae and the Fraudulent Inducement of Main Street. Because, in fact, under the law, what happened is, in my opinion, a fraudulent inducement, which is most of the mortgages originated between 1996 and now, in my opinion, as a matter of policy, were fraudulently induced. And so there's some very interesting legal questions. So one of the important things to understand about the mortgage bubble was that there was a real intentional decision by the Clinton administration leadership and then continued by the Bush administration leadership to float our way through that period with debt as opposed to productivity. And during that period, to shift a huge amount of capital out of the United States. As you know, between fiscal 1998 and 2001, over $4 trillion was moved out of the federal government, or there's $4 trillion of undocumentable adjustments. Part of my concern about that money, because people always say, how could you steal that much money, is fraudulent securities. And I'd like to tell you a story about something that happened in 1995. The reason, Byron, that we know about the missing money is because a group of us got laws passed in the early 90s that required the federal government to produce audited financial statements. When we all saw all the fraud on Iran-Contra, we just said, you know, the government should have audited financial statements and have to report. You know, if you give the government your 1040 form and say, here's how my money worked, the government should give you a form back and says, here's what we did with your money, here's how our money worked. So what happened, you know, that started to come out, and the requirement kicked in 1995, and when it did, I had a mortgage banker come to see me, very upset, very fretful. At the time, my company was lead financial advisor to FHA HUD, and he said, you know, my family's been in the mortgage banking business for three generations, and our core competency is keeping records of all the FHA mortgages and mortgage-backed securities secured by FHA mortgages in the market, and that's mortgage-backed securities as well as tax-exempt bonds. There's a huge cohort of tax-exempt bonds secured and supported by FHA or HUD programs and monies. And so he, you know, he had a huge pile of paper, Byron, and basically he said, you know, the outstanding securities and mortgages are many multiples of what is shown in the financial statement. Now, what he was saying was that the United States Treasury and the Federal Reserve, the New York Fed as depository, were engaging in systematic securities fraud. Well, I thought the guy was nuts. I mean, I just threw him out of my eyes. I was like, thank you very much. He said, I brought you a copy of my database. I said, no, it's not necessary. Thank you so much. Mm. You know, I just thought he was crazy.
This is 1995. So
this is 1995. Now, it was 1994. It was 2 years later I was targeted in an enemy of the state process led by Stanley Sporkin in the Department of Justice. And in that process, the software tools that we were building to equate the outstanding securities with with street data about homes were seized and destroyed. As you know, it's a long story, but and for many reasons that I won't go into, lots of allegations. There's a real question as to whether or not both the U.S. Treasury and government agencies, including the mortgage-backed securities, have engaged in significant securities fraud. And that's a real concern because very recently we saw at the end of 2004, and you can link to this at the Solari homepage, the U.S. Treasury in its 2004 consolidated report increased its liabilities by $11 trillion. So in 1 year, the U.S. government's liabilities, total liabilities, increased by $11 trillion. And my concern and question is, are they trying to authenticate the fraudulent securities? Now, this sounds like a lot of government accounting mumbo-jumbo, but let me explain what it means in practical terms. Henry Poole, who's a wonderful software developer member of the Solari team, once said in an interview in Insight magazine, he said, you know, I thought before I met Catherine that I owned my home. And then after I met Catherine and I understand the state of federal finances, what I realized, I don't own my own home. The creditors of the United States government own my home.
Indeed.
Because there's a point at which our total debt, both as consumers and state, local, and federal government, reaches a point where, you know, we're in the Latin America situation, which is the IMF, the World Bank, can dictate the terms, not just of how our money works, but how our government works and the rules and laws by which we will be governed.
Well, you know, you've covered so much, and I wonder if you wanted to back up a little bit and talk about some of the names of the people, if you care to, Catherine, because you and I have talked about this.
Sure.
Who engineered the bubble, sort of the politicians that made this thing happen?
Well, let me talk through a couple stories, because on the outline I put up a series of names. Let me just read them off: Alan Greenspan, Bob Rubin, Larry Summers, Franklin Raines, Andrew Cuomo, Nicholas Ratzinas, Stanley Sporkin, Jerry Hawke, Pug Whitaker, Charles Rossetti, Kit Bond, Mel Martinez. In the summer of 2000, I went to see the chief of staff to Kit Bond, who was the chairman of the Appropriation Committee in the Senate overseeing HUD.
Right.
So if the mortgage market is bubbling, if it's fraudulent, Kit Bond has the power to stop it.
Okay.
Because he controls the purse strings for Ginnie Mae and FHA and HUD.
Right.
So the person in question said to me, what do you think is going on at HUD? And Byron, I was just trying to get my company paid because they owe us money. So I was being very discreet. It was a stranger. I didn't know the person. They said, what do you think is going on at HUD? And I said, I don't know. What do you think is going on at HUD? And they looked at me and you know, just flat, straight, looked me in the eye and said, HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise.
So this is your attempt to collect money for your company, and this is what you get here back. So
well, but this is the chief of staff to the person who controls the appropriations in the Senate.
Yeah, so they know.
So this is the person, you know, if you want accountability, that's the guy who's got the power to shut the money off.
Right, yeah.
So she said, you know, HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise. Now, what you need to understand is at the time, HUD was run by Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin was paid $150 million a year to run HUD, run all the information systems in county, and then the New York Fed banks, the lead of which was Chase, J.P. Morgan, Chase, and Citibank. Now, if you understand how HUD works, you know, so much is controlled and operated by the Treasury and Department of Justice and those contractors that essentially you can't run HUD as a criminal enterprise unless those organizations are running HUD as a criminal enterprise. So, you know, it kind of took my breath away, but I remember I said, I don't disagree. Now, shortly thereafter, that committee, Kit Bond, a Republican in the lead, voted a $1.8 billion increase for HUD appropriations with, you know, with Cuomo and the Clinton administration in control, which will give you a sense of the bipartisan nature of the system and the intentionality of this mortgage bubble. This mortgage bubble was not designed with the best interest of the American citizens at heart.
Yes.
That's not the description of a governance system that one can trust or rely on. So one name in particular, we've taken the tact that if we're going to understand the markets around us and the money around us, it's very important not to focus on the president or the publicly visible people, but instead to focus on the people who really engineer the money both in the governmental sector and in the private sector, because doing something like this, Byron, requires extraordinary coordination between different parts of the financial system in different places. And we have an effort called the Internet Hot Seat, and we've hot seated a couple of the people on this list. One is Stanley Sporkin. We have a Stanley Sporkin hot seat. Sporkin was not only the person who was the general counsel when that MOU related to Iran-Contra was drafted, but he's the person the Bush administration just hired to help them, quote-unquote, clean up Fannie Mae. Well, you can't imagine. I mean, the thought of Stanley Sporkin cleaning, I just said, uh-oh, the fraud at Fannie Mae is now going to skyrocket. Every time they announce a new loss at Fannie Mae, I think, I wonder if Stanley helped anybody get that money. Mm. So we have a hot seat on Stanley Sporkin, one on Pug Whitaker, one on Jerry Hawk. These are all players who are involved, and I won't go through all of them. But they have a history of going back and forth between the public and private sector. And I think if we're going to get to an accountable financial system, it's very important that we start socially, in our minds, in our admiration, in our associations, start holding these folks accountable. I often hear, isn't Bob Rubin wonderful? Isn't Franklin Wentz wonderful? Isn't Alan Greenspan? Well, you know, these are the people who are managing it. If something's not working, they're the ones who are leading it. So part of accountability is holding them accountable for performance, and when I say performance, for a low popsicle index.
Yes. Well, Catherine, we're coming up to the Q&A time, and I think there's some other points you wanted to make about debt, drugs, and draft, as you were telling me earlier.
Right. If you look, all the questions about what I should do with my home, how I finance it, do I buy, do I rent, all these different questions, Byron, come down to the health of your place, your county, your town, your city, your neighborhood. And right now, most middle-class people are on a sort of treadmill, like the hamster on the wheel, in a place that involves a couple of critical issues. We're a hamster on the wheel because we're in a drain. If you look at the average American household, Northern Trust, which manages the president's trust, personal trust, did a study recently. It's up at the Solari Action Network that said U.S. households, I think, had a deficit in the prior fiscal year of $342 billion. So generally, the average American household is spending beyond its means, and it's been financing that through refinancing its house.
Right.
In fact, one of the quotes up on the event resource page in the outline is from Ed Steer. He says, oh, we've turned our homes into ATM machines. and that's worked as long as, the value of the housing was going up. We were pulling that equity out as we bubbled. The problem is, that works going up. It works, the opposite way going down. So we have this deficit. Now, where's that deficit coming from? Part of it is the falling income that I talked about. Part of it is simply, the more you take on debt, the more you have to carry that debt. And as your income goes down, it's a pincer movement. In addition, though, the biggest strain, Byron, is the fact that we are paying significant amount of taxes into a system that is not accountable. So, let's say on average in Tennessee, I pay $6,000 a year in federal taxes. As of the first Bush budget, 80% or more of that money goes to agencies that refuse to produce audited financial statement, and more often than not are financing a variety of activities which are very unproductive or economically harmful to my neighborhood. When HUD comes in and spends $250,000 per unit to do something that only takes $50,000 to do, the bad money crowds out the good. And so we end up, then you add on top of it the drugs coming in and the other sort of financial fraud and organized crime. And what you get is an economy that is increasingly controlled centrally because it is being manipulated through the debt and credit system. But in addition, is dependent more and more on subsidies. So, for example, let's take Hardeman County, where I live in Tennessee. We have a huge drug problem, different kinds of drugs. The latest one is meth lab. But if you look at the professional folks here, whether it's at the state mental institute or the prison, our entire economy is now dependent on the non-addicted people managing and processing the addicted people. And so drugs are a huge business. Part of it is, you know, the organized crime part of it, but part of it is all the various programs and subsidies coming from the federal government, the least of which is, or not the least of which is, the, you know, all the enforcement and judicial operations that it takes to process all these activities. So you have an entire county of people making money, you know, either taking drugs or going to prison or watching people take drugs or go to prison. Nobody's doing anything productive.
Catherine, does the bottom fall out at some point, or how does this resolve?
Well, there are two things that can happen, and this is the critical question, Byron, when you come down to saying, what should I do? The critical question is, are we going to go through 1989 again? We've bubbled the debt tremendously, far more than our productivity warrants and can pay off. So we could have another 1989 where things bust,
right,
and we repeat that scenario, at which point the opportunity is you don't want to buy a house now, or you want to sell now, and then you want to wait till it drops and you want to buy back in. That's the 1989 scenario, but there's another scenario because of the globalization of the economy, and that is the Iran-Contra folks, that those networks have pulled $10 trillion out of the economy. They've taken that money offshore. As the dollar, you know, that money's parked in Swiss francs and kroners and euros and, you know, in Chinese yuan and in other currencies. It's in gold. It's in precious metals. As the dollar drops, the value of that money doubles relative to the value of a dollar. So let's say, you know, the dollar's dropped about 30% in the last umpty-ump, but let's say it's half. So now that money comes back in, and it's worth $2 for every dollar. Now, most Americans won't see that, won't understand that, won't feel that. For example, there's a wonderful chart up on Henry Poole's website that shows here's the Dow Jones, and so the Dow Jones is kind of percolating around 10,000 plus, but here's the Dow Jones in dollars, or here's the Dow Jones in the value of gold, and what you see is when you measure the Dow Jones in euros, it's plummeting. We've lost, you know, most Americans who've stayed in the stock market have lost, you know, 30 cents on the dollar and don't even know it. They don't realize it. Now, in that scenario, you don't have an 89 where the house of, you know, the price of housing drops dramatically. The price of housing in nominal amounts stays the same, you know, but our income drops dramatically. Money comes in from abroad and is able to buy the real estate up in a way that pushes up prices. And so the middle class gets squeezed because our income is dropping, but our expenses are rising, and the cost of housing is going up. Remember, in 1989, that crash made a lot of housing affordable to a lot of people, including a lot of young people and first-time homebuyers. So the critical issue is, are we going to have a pump and dump, or are we going to have a pump that's a dump only if you look at this globally, but if you're an American, you're looking at being squeezed out of, you're looking at being gentrified out of your home by that money coming back in from other countries.
We're at the end, I think, now, Catherine, of this part of the program, and we've got really just about 10 minutes before we're going to end with a prayer tonight, as we do every night, and so I have a few questions, Catherine, and before I get to that, I wanted to urge everybody to go back and read the assigned readings because, you know, there's just so much incredible information here that one needs to bone up on this and get ready for next week where we're going to amplify on this. And could you say, just for a minute, Catherine, tell us about what's coming up next week and what you're going to cover that's different from tonight.
Yeah, what we're going to get into is really, okay, what does this mean to me in my place? And the single most important point I'm going to make, and that's why I wanted to go through sort of the bigger picture, is the single most important question is not, do you buy or sell your home or refinance it? The single most important question is, where do you want to live and who do you want to share your life with?
Got it.
Okay, because we all assume, oh, you know, I'm an American or I'm a Canadian, and so I'm going to be living in Montreal or I'm going to be living in Tulsa because that's where I live and that's where my family is. You know, a lot of people in Germany in 1933 thought the same thing. So, you know, the time has come to decide consciously if we have a financial system and a government run as a criminal enterprise, do we want to live here? Now, this is a particularly important question because the debt tax treadmill is also a draft treadmill.
Yes.
And there's very good reason to believe, that if they're not stealing your money, they're stealing your kids. And so there's a real question to be asked about, do I want to live here? And then, importantly, as we see the deterioration of the big centralized systems, the real questions, do you want to depend on corporate America for your water? Do you want to depend on corporate America for your food? Do you want to depend on corporate America for your energy? We know that there's tremendous suppressed technology when it comes to transportation, infrastructure, energy. One of the biggest wild cards in the future in terms of answering the question, where do I want to live, is what is the speed at which that technology gets unsuppressed? Because if it doesn't, we're going to continue to be dependent on fossil fuel, and as they centralize that market and we hit peak oil, then, of course, there's the rising prices. So we're talking about an environment where our risks are going up and an environment where we cannot look to the government for the rule of law. I mean, certainly I can speak to that, from my personal story. But I think whether it's the drugs or the World Trade Center or any of these other different activities, there's a real deterioration and everybody understands. So the question we're going to focus on, we're going to come back to again and again, is where do I want to live and who do I want to share my life with and what can I do to decrease my dependency on untrustworthy folks, whether it's in the financial markets or in the government. So that's one thing. But within that, Byron, there's so many incredible opportunities. There's so many incredible opportunities if and when we start to organize. So
that leads to maybe the first question. I'm scanning questions here, Catherine.
Uh-huh.
I have a few questions. And
okay.
I'm going to kind of sum up a couple of them and just put it this way. A Solari is a lifeboat that is, you have created this instrument. And could you just kind of, in terms of what we talked about tonight, tell us how that is a solution, or how does that relate to what we learned about the housing bubble tonight?
Well, the Solari is a conceptual framework for inventing solutions.
Yes.
We were prototyping doing Solaris in 1998 and were stopped.
Yes.
And I think it's really important to understand what we've built up is a toolkit. We prototyped about $12 billion to try and figure out where the opportunities were to re-engineer the money.
Yes.
And those are existent. But this is something, it's a toolkit. But inventing all of this is going to have to be done by all of us on an out-of-control basis. We're going to have to invent this together. There are two critical parts to a Solari from the point of view of this current discussion. One is what we're hoping to launch shortly are Solari Investor Circles, which is really just an investment club. It's a cross, Byron, between an investment club and and sort of a French resistance cell. I always tell people, don't worry about if there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one.
Oh, boy.
So it's an investment club that focuses not just on your money and your time, but its goal is to use our understanding of economic warfare to help people really save each other money, save time, and start to really organize to re-engineer their money quietly in sort of viral ways that help to shift that lowers their cost of capital and raises the tapeworm's cost of capital, but the entire focus, Byron, is do what gives you energy today. The theory is that the tapeworm's gotten too much of our energy. We need to get it back now. So it's very much focused on self-interest. So those are investment clubs. Those are informal. They're not jobs. But one of the things we're looking to do is in a place build a constituency of people who see the opportunity in financing small business. As small business has been starved for capital, there's a real opportunity to get together and do a venture fund for your neighborhood, which is the original focus of Solari. And the arbitrage opportunities are fantastic, Byron, particularly if the local folks see the financial opportunities that can come from organizing their purchases and their investments and not only creating jobs locally, but getting a piece of the action when they do. So those ideas are very useful, and we've tried to write up as much as we can in the site, but a lot of communities are going to have to try this, and over time we're going to have to see what works and what doesn't. And so we're certainly going to be supportive of the invention process. But when you re-engineer all the money on the planet, that's not something that one person or one company can do. We're going to have to invent that.
A couple more questions here, Catherine. We've just got a couple of minutes left. This one says, timing on the bubble burst. That's all it says.
Oh, wouldn't I give anything to know that.
Anything you can say to give us a guideline on that?
I could not believe that they could keep the thing going this long.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would have bet any amount of money that they could not have kept this bubble going as long as they have. And it's only been as I started to study what you can do with promise software and what you can do with a lot of the invisible weaponry that I started to realize, you know, we now have created the covert operation sufficient to keep this bubble going forever. You know, that's kind of the Orwellian scenario, the slow burn scenario I talk about, where literally we simply keep liquidating people and countries and things to get the subsidy we need to keep the bubble going.
Well, maybe one of the limits will be the collapse of the environment itself.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely.
But you know, the reality is we live and exist in a culture of force. Now, many of us, you know, someone like me until the enemy of the state period, you know, had the benefit of living inside the bubble. And so, you know, that force generated financial security for the people who lived inside the bubble. You know, but there's no way you can keep this going unless you, you know, it gets progressively meaner and meaner. And it appears that now, you know, more of us than not are targets and as opposed to protected by that bubble. So, you know, my preference is the bubble bursts. I think most of the people on this call are going to be infinitely better off if the bubble bursts than in a slow burn. Because in a burst, productivity is going to become relevant again.
We just got about a minute, Catherine, to close out. If there's like a couple of clear, one person just asked, could you come to a clear statement of the situation that I can take home with me? What would that be?
You're playing in a rigged game.
Yes.
That forget markets and forget the rule of law. You're playing in a rigged game. The game's called economic warfare. You're the target. Unless you have a map and a plan and allies to play to win in economic warfare, you're going to lose. And at the very heart of that economic warfare game is the value of your home and how you finance your home and whether or not you own your home. Given the financial situation in the government. So, and that's why I say if you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one, because all bets are off financially as to whether there is a United States government and how we're going to be governed in the future.
Thank you, Catherine, for this profound evening together, and we'll see you all next week for Navigate the Housing Bubble 2. Thank you again all for signing up and registering and being part of this. Now we're going to end tonight with Ileana Obadja, who's our spiritual minister on the Solari team, and she'll finish up with a prayer tonight. Ileana, please proceed.
Good evening, everyone. I just want to take a minute because everything that has been said goes into us into a place where we can reach for the highest divine guidance that we have access to for our understanding, for learning how to make correct choices for ourselves and our families and our community and our world. So whatever the divine purpose is that lives in you for your life and what you are trying to create as a life-sustaining and a life-creative way of living on this earth, we're just going to take a moment in silence and just ask that every bit of inspiration, of support, of creativity can come into our decision-making and into our relationships with each other and into the things that we are setting about to do. So we'll just do that for a moment in silence. And as you go about your week now, thinking about what you've received tonight and understanding that you have access to a map, to a plan, to begin to gather your allies, as Catherine said, that there is always, always divine guidance, and that that which is life-producing is always supported. We give thanks each in our own way to the source of life that sustains us all and bonds us all together. And so it is. Good evening, everyone.